After a few minutes, Tommy and Gabe begin to play cards in front of the fire because there's no one to tell them not to. Finn just watches because he hasn't decided whether or not it's a sin. Sean joins me by the counter, standing close enough that I can smell hay and salt water and dust on him. "Give me something to do," he says. I put a knife in his hand. "Cut something. Your bread." He begins to cut it with single-minded devotion. In a low voice, he says,
"I saw Ian Privet after you'd gone. He took Pender out after the rest were gone and ran him hard. He was fast before, and he's fast again. One to watch."
"I heard that he likes to come up fast from the outside at the end." Sean glanced at me, an eyebrow raised.
"True enough. Privet lost him 4 years ago when he fell in the races. He beat me twice on him before that."
"He won't beat you this year," I say. Sean doesn't say anything. He doesn't have to. I know he's thinking about losing Cor. I stir the chicken. It's done, but I don't want to have to sit at the table yet. After a pause, he says,
"I was thinking, no one will want the inside, since the sea will be bad on the first of the month."
"So I should hug the sea because Dove won't care." Sean's done slicing the bread too, but he rearranges the pieces as if he still works at it. I say, "I was thinking too that I should hang back, save Dove for the end."
"And maybe the pack will have thinned," Sean considers. "I wouldn't wait too long or hang too far back. She's not strong enough to come up from too far back."
"I want to stay clear of the piebald, and she'll be at the front," I say. "I've seen the way Mutt rides her." Sean narrows his eyes. I can tell he's pleased that I've noticed, and I'm pleased that he's pleased.
"Blackwell's the other one," Sean says. "He's the one whose stallion tried to take you down. But he got a replacement horse. This new one's a fast bitch."
He says it without malice. "Of course, there's one horse that I know will be a contender. But I've never seen him in a real race, and I've never seen his rider give me the slightest hint of how he likes to pace himself." "Where will you and Cor be?" I ask. Sean presses two fingers along the edge of the counter, sweeping crumbs into a pile. I notice that his fingers are permanently dirt-stained, like mine. He says,
"Right next to you and Dove."
I stare at him. "You can't risk not winning. Not because of me." Sean doesn't lift his eyes from the counter.
"We make our move when you make yours. You on the inside, me on the outside. Cor can come from the middle of the pack. He's done it before. It's one side you won't have to worry about."
I say, "I will not be your weakness, Sean Kendrick." Now he looks at me. He says, very softly,
"It's late for that, Puck."
He leaves me standing at the counter, looking into the sink, trying to remember what I was supposed to do next.
"Puck!" snaps Gabe. "Your soup!"
The dumplings are boiling over, and for a moment, it appears that we may have flames for dinner. But I manage to snatch the pot and get the heat off. The boys all hover around the table now that the presence of food seems imminent. Tommy says,
"You're right, Gabe. She does make a mean chicken. Try to bite her." "Ah, but Pup bites back," Gabe says.
Finn begins to dole the dumplings out into bowls
while I swipe up the spill.
Tommy chatters on about how his Ishgamare lets herself get pushed around by the other horses, but perks up when she sees their asses. Gabe gives everyone a glass of water, whether or not they ask for it. And all the while I try very hard to keep my eyes from darting to Sean, because I'm quite certain that no one at the table will be able to miss how I look at him and how I find him looking back.
Chapter 53. Sean. I wake to the sound of crying. I got back too late. It took sleep too long to come to me. For a moment, I just lie there. Exhaustion makes me unwilling to fully wake. And yet, the crying. The sound resolves itself into an agonized keening, and I am awake. I am awake, and I have my jacket and my boots, and I am in the stairwell with my flashlight. The stable is dark, but I hear the sounds of movement, not from the aisles, but from the stalls. The horses are awake. Either the sound has woken them, or someone has been here. I keep my flashlight switched off and make my way in the dark. The moaning grows louder as I creep down to the main floor. It's coming from Kor's old stall, the one I just put Adana in. I slide down the aisle as quickly as silence allows. The crying has gone silent, but I'm certain now that it's Adana. In the darkness, I can barely see inside the stall. The night outside throws some dark blue light in, just enough for me to press myself against the bars and look in. When she keens again, I start back. She's right by my face. Her head lies against the bars, neck pressed against the wall, nose pointed toward the ceiling, jaw cracked open. I whisper her name, and she cries back to me softly. My eyes follow the line of her neck to her sloping withers and the slanting line her hips make low to the ground. I've never seen a horse stand like this. There's a sick knot inside me as I pull open the door and step into the stall. Now, her body silhouetted against the light of the window, I see that she leans against the wall with her head and neck, sunk down onto her haunches like a dog. Her back legs splay out as if the ground is slippery. I touch her shoulder. It's trembling. I have a terrible feeling rising inside me. I run the flat of my hand from her withers down her spine, and then, crouching to keep searching, around the curve of her twitching haunches and down toward her hamstring. Adana whimpers. My hand comes away soaked. I lift it toward my eyes, but I don't need it any closer to smell the blood on it. I snatch my flashlight from my pocket and flick it on. Both of her hamstrings have been sliced. The top edge of the wound curves up like a ghastly smile, and blood pools around her hocks. I go to her head and she struggles, trying to get her legs under her. I stroke her forelock and whisper in her ear, "Be still. Don't be afraid." I wait for her breathing to become easier, for her to believe me. She'll never walk again. I can't understand it. I don't understand who would mutilate Adana, a horse that wasn't in the races, a horse that was no threat to anyone. And like this, this savage cruelty, I was meant to find her and be sickened. I can think of only one person who would want to hurt me like that. I think I hear a rustle somewhere in the depths of the stable. I flick off the flashlight. In the dark, in his stall, Adana's bay coat looks very much like Kor's blood-red one. It would be very easy to mistake them if you were expecting Kor and were concentrating on getting into the stall without getting hurt. There's movement again, farther away in the stable. I scramble out of the stall and into the aisle. I stand and wait, listening. My heart has already raced ahead of me. All I want is for the sound to be from anywhere but the back seven stalls. All I want is for Mutt Malvern to have guessed wrong when he went looking for Kor. There are five other stalls equipped for the Capel Ishka. He could have gone looking in any of them after he discovered Adana was the wrong horse. I hear the commotion again. It's from the back seven stalls. Now, I run. I strike the lights on as I round the corner by the door. If he knows I am here, surely he will abandon this. "Mutt!" I shout. Now, under the light, I see blood on the floor, the edge of a shoe printing scarlet every step. I jog along, following, watchful.
"You've gone too far! Mutt!"
My voice echoes in the high arches of the stable. There's no reply. Perhaps he's left. Kor screams. Now I run like I've never run. I can see Adana in my mind, her head stretched unnaturally toward the ceiling as she lies against the wall, ruined in her own skin and not yet knowing it. If he has touched Kor, I will kill him. I burst around the corner. The door to Kor's stall is open. Mutt Malvern stands with a wicked blade in one hand, and, in the other, a three-pronged Leicester spear of the sort used to poach fish or birds. The iron heads of the spear press into Kor's shoulder, forcing him back against the wall. His skin shivers and ripples under the metal. Mutt Malvern has given some thought to this plan of his.
"Get away from him,"
I say.
"Every drop of his blood will be 10 of yours."
"Sean Kendrick," Mutt replies. "Pretty foul of you to swap stools like that."
Kor makes a low roar in his throat, a sound that we feel in our feet instead of hear. But he's pinned by the Leicester spear, not only points of iron, but three of them as well.
"If you knew a thing about the horses under this roof, you would have known the difference between them, even in the dark."
Mutt glances at me long enough to see that I've closed the distance between us. He jerks his chin toward the spear.
"Stay out of this stall, knacker!"
I slowly wipe my bloody hand across my jacket and draw my switchblade from my pocket. I show it to him. Mutt regards it with contempt.
"How is it you're thinking you'll stop me with that wee thing?"
The blade snaps out audibly. Mutt would not be the largest thing to die on the slender point of it.
"I don't think I'll stop you," I say. "I think that you will cut my horse, and then when you come out of that stall, I will use this to cut your heart out and hand it to you."
I am sick to the ends of my fingers. I cannot look at Kor's eye or I won't be steady. Mutt says,
"Do you really think I believe that you can do anything to me while I have these in my hands?"
But he does believe. I can see it in his eyes. I say,
"What's it you hope to prove in there? That you are the better horseman? That the horses love you better? Do you mean to carve your father's approval in the side of every Capel Ishka on this island?"
"No," says Mutt. "Just this one."
"Will that be enough?" I ask. "What will be next?"
"There is no next," Mutt says. "This beast's the only thing you care about."
He looks at my face, though, and he's not quite sure. Maybe because it wasn't meant to happen with me watching. I was meant to come down in the morning and find Kor as I just found Idana. Maybe because he is looking at me and dreaming of a better way to hurt me. Surely I must know something that would satisfy Mutt more than crippling Kor. There must be something. I think of his contorted face at the auction and I say,
"You really want to prove something to your father? You've got to win against us. Beat us on the sand."
His face shifts. That fiendish piebald has him well fascinated. Mutt glances at me again, then back at the points of the spear on Kor's shoulder. I know what is going through his head, because it's going through mine as well. Benjamin Malvern telling George Holly that I am the rightful heir to the yard. The name Scarter printed on the board at the butcher's. The breathless speed of the piebald. It's a siren song, and it wins him over. Mutt backs out of the stall. Kor charges up toward the space he leaves behind. His eyes are wild. I see the pricks of blood the spear has left in his shoulder. And when Mutt slides the door shut, I spring onto Mutt and press my little switchblade to his great bulging neck. I can see his skin sucking in with his pulse. My knife lies right next to it.
"I thought you said to beat you on the sand,"
Mutt says. Kor slams the wall of his stall with his hooves. My voice hisses out through a cage of my teeth.
"I also said 10 drops of your blood for every drop of his."
I want a pool of his blood around him like the one beneath Idana. I want him to lie against this wall and whimper like she does. I want him to know he'll never stand again. I want him to remember David Prince's death mask as he wears it for himself.
"Sean Kendrick,"
the voice comes from behind me. I incline my head even as Mutt's eye catches mine.
"It is late for this sort of entertainment, isn't it?"
With great reluctance, I snap the blade away and step backward from Mutt. Mutt's hands remain by his side with the spear and his wicked carving knife still dark with blood. We both face his father, who stands with Daly at the entrance to the aisle. He wears a buttoned undershirt that he must have been sleeping in, but he is no less powerful looking in it. Daly, shamefaced, won't meet my eyes.
Matthew, your bed is lonely.
His voice is cordial, although his posture is not. Malvern meets Mutt's gaze, and for a moment, nothing happens. Then Malvern's expression hardens, and Mutt strides past him without a word or glance toward me. Malvern turns his eyes to me. I am shaking still, struck with what Mutt nearly did to Cor and with what I was ready to do to Mutt.
Mr. Daly, Malvern says without turning his head, thank you for your assistance. You may return to your bed.
Daly nods and vanishes. Benjamin Malvern stands an arm's length from me, his eyes steady on me. He says,
do you have anything to say?
I would not. I close my eyes for a moment. I need to get my bearings. I need to find the stillness inside me. I cannot find it. I'm destroyed. I stand in the ocean, my hands cupped to the sky. I'm immovable in the current. I open my eyes. Have been sorry. Malvern cocks his head. For a long moment he looks at me, at the switchblade in my hand, at my face. Then he folds his arms behind his back.
Mr. Kendrick, go put that mare out of her misery.
He turns and walks from the stable. Chapter 54. Sean. The next day is bitter and ruthless. The wind races around the horses' feet and makes them wild. Overhead, clouds like ragged breath flee in front of the cold. There's a grey ocean above and below us. I meet Puck at the head of the cliff road. She frowns when she sees me. I know my face must be a wasteland of fatigue after last night. Her hair is held down by a lumpy knitted hat, but a few strands snap across her face. The vendors are struggling to keep their tents from flying away. The riders heading down the cliff path endeavor to keep their mounts from doing the same. Puck tugs down the edge of her hat with one hand. Something nearby creaks and groans in the wind. Dove tosses her head. I see terror in her wide eyes.
Take Dove home, I tell her. This isn't a day to be on the beach.
There isn't any more time, she replies. I thought you said I should get used to the beach. There's no more time.
I have to shout to be heard over the wind. I spread my empty palms to the sky.
Do you see Cor in my hands? This isn't a beach you want to get used to.
Killing sands. That was what my father called a day like today. Today the riders would die because they didn't know, or because they were desperate, or because they were foolishly brave. Puck frowns at the cliff road. I see her uncertainty in the wrinkle between her eyebrows.
If you trust me on anything, don't risk today. You're ready as you'll ever be, I say. Everyone else is robbed the extra day too.
She bites her lip in dark frustration, looks at the ground for a moment, and then, like that, she's done.
It is what it is, I reckon. Is Tommy Fork down there?
I don't know. My interests don't lie with Tommy Fork.
Hold Dove,
she says, when I can't answer to her satisfaction.
I'm going to get him if he's down there.
I don't want her on the beach, on a horse, or off it.
I'll go look for him. Take her home. We'll both go,
Puck says.
Wait a moment. I'll get Elizabeth to tie her behind the booth. Don't move.
I watch Puck make her way back to Fathom and Son's booth and get into a spirited discussion with one of the sisters who tends it.
That's a poor match, Sean Kendrick,
says a voice at my elbow. It's the other sister from Fathom and Son's, and she follows my gaze to Puck.
Neither of you are a housewife.
I don't look away from Puck. I think you assume too much, Dory Maud.
You leave nothing to assumption,
Dory Maud says.
You swallow her with your eyes. I'm surprised there's any of her left for the rest of us to see.
I shift my glance to her. Dory Maud is a hard-looking woman, clever and industrious, and even I know from my perch at the Malvern Yard that she could fight the strongest man on the island for the last penny in his pocket.
And what is she to you, then?
Dory Maud's expression is canny.
What you are to Benjamin Malvern? Only less salary and more affection.
We both look back to Puck, who has won the battle with Elizabeth and Ty's dove behind the booth. This ill wind throws both the ends of her hair and dove's mane to and fro. I remember the feel of Puck's ponytail in my hand, the heat of her skin when I tucked her hair into her collar.
She doesn't know any better,
Dory Maud says.
What a girl like her needs is a man with both his legs on the land, a man who will hold her down so that she doesn't fly away. She doesn't know yet that someone like you looks better on the shelf than in your hand.
I can hear in her voice that she means no cruelty by it, but I say, someone to hold her down just as you are held.
I hold myself down,
snaps Dory Maud.
You and I both know what you love, and those races are a jealous lover.
And now I hear in her voice that she knows this firsthand. But she's pegged me wrong, because it's not the races I love. Puck comes up to us just then, still wearing the vicious smile from winning the battle with Elizabeth.
Dory! Watch yourself on that beach,
Dory Maud says, and then she leaves us behind with a bit of a growl. Puck mutters something about bad tempers.
Have you changed your mind?
I ask her.
I never do, she says.
The beach is every bit as bad as I'd guessed. The sky is down near the sand, and occasional rain hits our faces like sea spray. From our vantage on the cliff road, I can see the thrashing ocean, the Capel Ishka blowing across the black, wet sand, the quarrels between horses and the smears of red down the beach. A dark, dead Capel lies out flat by the surf, every wave washing around its legs but not moving it. It's not only humans this is dangerous for. Puck says,
Do you see Tommy?
I do not, but only because there's much to see in this ceaselessly moving play. Rain hisses in my ears. She pushes down the path, and I have no choice but to follow her. At the base are a few huddled spectators and a race official. One of the Carrolls, I think. An uncle of Brian and Jonathan's. I stop to talk to him, my head ducked down into my collar.
What's been happening down here?
My voice is thin in the wind. My eyes are on the dead water horse.
Fighting! The horses are fighting! The sea's driving them mad!
Is Tommy Falk down here?
I ask him.
Falk!
Black mare!
He says,
They're all black when they're wet.
Tommy Falk?
Echoes one of the spectators next to him. A mainlander by his navy suit coat and tie, even down here on the sand.
Good-looking boy.
I have no idea if he is or not.
Maybe yes at that.
He points toward the curve of the cliffs. The race official, as an afterthought, adds,
Someone was looking for you, Mr. Kendrick.
I wait for him to say who, but he doesn't, so I step away. In all this, I've lost Puck. Everyone looks the same in this vile weather. If all of the Capel Ishka are black when they're wet, so is every human. The beach is populated by dark, insensible beasts and the smaller, dark creatures on their backs. There's no point calling for her. In 5 feet, all sound becomes the savage howl of the wind. With my eyes, I finally find not Puck, not Tommy Falk, but his mare. She is blacker than a mirror and unmistakable with her fine bone. She stands about 10 lengths away in the shelter of the cliffs, tied near another Capel Ishka, her head low to the ground. The mare's still in her tack, but there's no sign of Tommy Falk about her. I think perhaps that Puck has seen her as well, so I head toward the mare across the loose stones of the high beach. But before I get even halfway there, I find Puck, tucked behind the curve of the cliff road, slightly protected from the weather. There are 4 bodies stretched out parallel to each other, dark outlines on the pale beach, casualties of the morning. Puck crouches beside one of them, not touching or even looking at it. just hunched down against the wind, studying the ground between her feet. I walk over to stand beside her and look down at the battered face of Tommy Fork.
Chapter 55. Puck. The next day is both the last day before the races and Tommy Fork's funeral. I am driven to distraction by the idea of the race tomorrow, which feels like a disservice to Tommy. But when I try to tell myself Tommy Fork is dead, all I can think about is him and Gabe tossing that chicken around our house. When I leave with Dove, Gabe is still lying in his bed, his door cracked open so that I can see that he stares up at the ceiling. By the time I get home, he has moved the debris I've put in front of the fence section the Kapil Ishka destroyed, and is smashing nails into boards. I can't stay in the house, because I keep thinking that tomorrow is the race, and tomorrow is only one night's sleep away. So Finn and I go to Dory Maud's to help her get a new batch of catalogues ready to mail. When we get back, Gabe has transformed the yard, pulled up every weed and piled every bit of scrap into a heap behind the lean-to, but I can see that it hasn't made him forget that Tommy Fork is dead. When we walk into the yard, he looks at us for half a minute before his face changes into something like recognition. His hands are shaky, and I make him eat something. I don't think he's stopped working all day. As afternoon turns into evening, Beach Grattan arrives, and he and Gabe exchange a grim-lipped greeting. Then we're dressed and off to the Western Cliffs. Gabe doesn't tell us much about Tommy's funeral, only that the Forks are old Thisbe, and that means that the funeral will involve neither St. Columba nor Father Mooneyham, but will instead take place on the rocks by the sea. Finn looks nervous at this, as anything that involves his immortal soul tends to make him nervous. But Gabe tells him to be decent, and that it's just as good a religion as any brand that our parents wore, that the Forks were the best sort of people you'd want to meet. He says it all in a very faraway sort of voice, like he is pulling the words from a storage cabinet for us. I sense that he's drowning, but I don't have any idea of how to start to put my hand into the water to save him. We have to pick our way across the long, ragged cliffs to the western beach, which is rockier and more uncertain than the racing beach. The ocean is glazed gold in the evening light, and there is a fire burning just out of the reach of the water. We're met by a small funeral party. I recognize many of my father's fishermen friends among them. "Thank you for coming, Gabe," says Tommy Fork's mother. I see now that she's the one who Tommy had gotten his lips from, but if the rest of her is beautiful, I can't tell, because her eyes are red and small from loss. She takes Gabe's hands. Gabe says, so serious that I'm suddenly ferociously proud of him, despite everything, "Tommy was my best friend on this island. I'd have done anything for him." She says something back, but I don't hear what it is, because I'm so surprised to see that Gabe is crying. He's still speaking to her quite plainly, but as he does, tears course down his cheeks with every blink. I find, weirdly, that I can't watch him do it, so I leave him and Finn with her and move toward the fire. It only takes me a moment to realize that it's not just a bonfire, but a pyre. It smokes and crackles, the loudest thing on the beach. The flames are orange and white against the deep blue of the evening sky, and the wet, flat sand reflects them like a mirror. Each wave extinguishes the reflection and then returns it. It's been burning for a very long time, with a mound of glowing coals and ash beneath it, and I am stricken when I see a somehow unmolested scrap of Tommy Falk's jacket caught on the timbers. I think he was just sitting at our table in that jacket.
"Puck, isn't it?"
I look to my left and see a man standing there, his arms folded neatly in front of him, as if he stands in church. Of course, I know that he's Norman Falk, now that I look at him, because I remember him standing in our kitchen the exact same way, talking to my mother. I just always thought of his face and thought fisherman, not Tommy Falk's father. Beside him is a kid, possibly one of Tommy's siblings. Norman Falk doesn't look anything like Tommy. He smells like Gabe, which is to say, like fish. I'm sorry about this, I say, because that's what people said to me after our parents died. Norman Falk's eyes are dry as he looks into the pyre. The boy leans against his leg, and Norman Falk puts a hand on his shoulder. We would have lost him either way. It seems a funny sort of comfort. I can't imagine thinking that about Gabe. There is Gabe being dead, which is forever. And there is Gabe being happy somewhere. I might never see him again. It might feel the same to me, but I'm quite certain it wouldn't feel the same to Gabe. He was very brave, I offer, because it sounds polite in my head. My face is getting hot from the flames. I want to step back, but I don't want to seem like I'm stepping away from the conversation. That he was. Everyone will remember him on that mare. There's naked pride in Norman Falk's voice. We've asked Sean Kendrick to give her back to the sea, and he said yes. We're doing it right for Tommy. I ask, ever so polite, trying to pretend that Sean Kendrick's name hasn't interested me. Give her back to the sea, sir? Norman Falk spits behind him, hard, so that he won't spit on the boy at his side, and then turns back to the pyre. Yes, releasing her the proper way. Give the dead some respect, like we used to. Give the capel some respect. It's not about the tourists coming in and lining pockets. It's about the Capel Ishka and us, and anything less than that makes it a dirty sport. Then he seems to remember who he's talking to, because he says, There's no place for you on the beach now, Puck Connolly. You and your mare shouldn't be. I knew your father, and I liked him, but I think what you're doing's wrong, if you'll hear me. I feel shamed for no reason I can name, and then I feel bad that I've let myself be shamed. I don't mean to be disrespectful. Norman Falk's voice is kind enough. Course you don't. You just don't have a mum and dad to set you right. That horse of yours is just a horse, is the problem. If the Scorpio races are just horse races, then all this, Norman Falk jerks his chin toward the flames, was just a bloody shame, and nothing else. 2 weeks ago, I would have thought he was crazy, that of course it was just about the race, the money, the thrill. And if I'd just been watching the training on the beach, I probably would have still said that. But now that I've spent time with Sean Kendrick, now that I've been on the back of Core, I feel something inside me slipping. I'm still not sure it was worth Tommy dying for. But I can see the allure of having one foot on the land and one foot in the sea. I've never known Thisbe so well as I have these last few weeks. The boy says something to Norman Falk, and he replies, He's bringing her down now. Look, there now. We both turn our heads, and there is Sean, halfway down one of the little paths to the beach. He holds Tommy's black mare, and in comparison to Cor, she looks fragile in his hands. Sean wears nothing ritual or unusual, just his same blue-black jacket with his collar turned up. I feel a strange, fierce squeeze in my heart when I see him, like pride, although there's nothing about Sean that I can take credit for. He leads the black mare across the sand toward us, pausing only when she half rears and squeals, soft as a bird cry. The funeral party gathers by the pyre, to watch as he walks her to the water's edge. It's only then that I notice that Sean's feet are bare. The surf rushes around his ankles, soaking the bottom few inches of his pants. The mare lifts her hooves high as the water courses in around her pasterns, and then she cries out to the sea. There is something not quite horse-like about her eyes already. When she snaps at Sean, he simply ducks out of the way and twists his fingers in her forelock, pulling her head down. I see his mouth moving, but it's impossible to hear what he tells her. beside me, Tommy's father says,
"From the sea, to the sea."
And I realize that the words match the movement of Sean's mouth. I wonder then at how many times this moment's taken place. Not with Sean saying the words, but with anyone. It's like the moment at the Bloody Stone when I declared Dove as my mount. I feel the pull of my legs to Thisbe, the invisible presences of a thousand rituals, weights around my ankles. Sean looks to the group and calls,
"The ashes!"
Another boy, another sibling maybe, this one looks a little like Tommy, hurries across the sand toward Sean. The light is failing quickly, so I can't see what he's carrying the ashes in. They must have just been taken from the pyre. Sean holds a hand over the vessel, as if testing the temperature, and then he cautiously reaches in. The mare tosses her head and calls out again, and Sean hurls the handful of ashes into the air above her. Sean's voice is a wind-torn, weightless thing across the sand, but Norman Fork says the words along with him.
"May the ocean keep our brave."
With his back to us, Sean tugs the halter from the mare's head. She kicks out, but he steps out of the way as if it were nothing at all. With a shake of her mane, she leaps mightily into the water. For a moment she struggles over the waves, and then she is swimming. Just a wild black horse in a deep blue sea, full of the ashes of other dead boys. Then, so sudden and swift that I miss the moment of her disappearing, she's gone, and there's only the swaying of the ocean surface. Sean stands at the edge of the surf, looking out at the sea, and there is something curious and longing in his expression, like he, too, wishes to leap into the ocean and be gone. I think, just then, that this is why Norman Fork asked for Sean to be there. Not because he was the only one who could perform the ritual, but because Sean Kendrick, looking like that, is the races, even if no race was ever run. A reminder of what the horses mean to the island, a bridge between what we are and that thing about Thisbe that we all want but can't seem to touch. When Sean stands there, his face turned out to the sea, he is no more civilized than any of the Capel Ishka, and it unsettles me. My heart feels full and empty with all of the beginnings and endings. Tomorrow is the races, with all of their strategy and danger and hope and fear. And on the other side of it is Gabe, getting into a boat and leaving us. I feel like Sean looking out over the ocean. I'm so full of an unnamed wanting that I can't bear it.
Chapter 56. Sean. After I release Tommy Fork's mare, I'm drawn into the funeral party. By the light of the fire, everyone's face is a secret until you are right upon them. I search one and then the other. I see Gabriel Connolly and Finn Connolly, but not Puck. I ask Finn with his scarecrow posture if Puck had come with them, and he says, "Of course," but no more. I move through the group, touching elbows and asking after her, thinking all the while that to do so is to shout my feelings about her. No one has seen her. The race is tomorrow, and I've done my part for Tommy Fork, and I should go back to the yard, but I feel hollow, knowing that Puck's here somewhere and I haven't found her. I need to find her, and the needing disquiets me. For a long moment I stand on the rocks, imagining where she would be, and then I climb back up the cliff path. The ground is dark, but here, closer to the sky, the evening air is still dark and red. Elsewhere on Thisbe it must be night, but here we still have a whisper of the evening sun, far away across the western sea. I find her there at the top of the cliff, facing the horizon. Her knees are pulled up to her chin and her arms wrapped around them. She looks like she has grown from the rocks and dirt around her. Though she hears my footsteps, her eyes keep searching the sea. I draw myself up next to her and look at her profile, making no effort to disguise my attention here, where there is only Puck to see me. The evening sun loves her throat and her cheekbones. Her hair, the color of cliff grass, rises and falls over her face in the breeze. Her expression is less ferocious than usual, less guarded. I say, "Are you afraid?" Her eyes are far away on the horizon line, out to the west where the sun has gone but the glow remains. Somewhere out there are my Kapil Ishka, George Holly's America, every gallon of water that every ship rides on. Puck doesn't look away from the orange glow at the end of the world.
Tell me what it's like. The race.
What it's like is a battle. A mess of horses and men and blood. The fastest and strongest of what is left from 2 weeks of preparation on the sand. It's the surf in your face. The deadly magic of November on your skin. The Scorpio drums in the place of your heartbeat. It's speed, if you're lucky. It's life and it's death, or it's both. And there's nothing like it. Once upon a time, this moment, this last light of evening the day before the race, was the best moment of the year for me. The anticipation of the game to come. But that was when all I had to lose was my life.
There's no one braver than you on that beach.
Her voice is dismissive.
That doesn't matter.
It does. I meant what I said at the festival. This island cares nothing for love, but it favors the brave. Now she looks at me. She's fierce and red, indestructible and changeable, everything that makes Thisbe what it is. She asks,
"Do you feel brave?"
The Mare Goddess had told me to make another wish. It feels thin as a thread to me now, that gift of a wish. I remember the years when it felt like a promise.
I don't know what I feel, Puck.
Puck unfolds her arms just enough to keep her balance as she leans to me, and when we kiss, she closes her eyes. She draws back and looks into my face. I have not moved, and she barely has, but the world feels strange beneath me.
Tell me what to wish for,
I say.
Tell me what to ask the sea for. To be happy. Happiness.
I close my eyes. My mind is full of Kaur, of the ocean, of Puck Connolly's lips on mine.
I don't think such a thing is had on Thisbe.
And if it is, I don't know how you would keep it. The breeze blows across my closed eyelids, scented with brine and rain and winter. I can hear the ocean rocking against the island, a constant lullaby. Puck's voice is in my ear. Her breath warms my neck inside my jacket collar.
You whisper to it, what it needs to hear. Isn't that what you said?
I tilt my head so that her mouth is on my skin. The kiss is cold where the wind blows across my cheek. Her forehead rests against my hair. I open my eyes and the sun has gone. I feel as if the ocean is inside me, wild and uncertain.
That's what I said. What do I need to hear?
Puck whispers.
That tomorrow we'll rule the Scorpio races as King and Queen of Skarmath, and I'll save the house, and you'll have your stallion. Dove will eat golden oats for the rest of her days, and you will terrorize the races each year, and people will come from every island in the world to find out how it is you get horses to listen to you. The Piebald will carry Mutt Malvern into the sea, and Gabriel will decide to stay on the island. I will have a farm, and you will bring me bread for dinner.
I say, that is what I needed to hear.
Do you know what to wish for now?
I swallow. I have no wishing shell to throw into the sea when I say it, but I know that the ocean hears me nonetheless. To get what I need.
Chapter 57 Puck. It used to be that before Dad went onto the boat, the house would be alive with movement. Even if he left early in the morning, or late at night to follow the shoals and the tides, Mum would be up baking things for him to take with him, and Gabe would be sitting in his room, making certain he packed his razor, and Finn and I would be clutching his legs, or climbing into his bag, or getting into Mum's flower. The day that they both went out together, it was me baking for them, and Gabe watching what Mum packed, and Finn sulking, unhappy that they were leaving. Now, the morning of the Scorpio races. I feel like I'm the one going out on the boat. Finn's anxiously checking my pack, and Gabe's polishing my boots, and I'm tugging my hair into a ponytail and thinking, is this really it? We can afford to be inefficient. The morning is dominated by the shorter, less serious races, and so I won't have to be out there with Dove until the early afternoon. At one point, I reach into the biscuit tin, meaning to get some money just in case I need to buy something for Dove. My fingers touch the cool, bare bottom of the jar. We finally used it all. As if I needed the reminder of why I was racing. Nerves creep along the back of my neck. When I finally head out, Finn says that he will bring me lunch. Not that I can imagine ever eating, as my guts are a bed of snakes, which makes for poor digestion. And Gabe follows me out of the house. Puck, he says, don't do this. He leans over the fence and watches me toss Dove's girth over the back of her saddle. He looks a lot like Dad now, in this light, since he hasn't been sleeping and he's got the lines under his eyes. He's starting to look a little like one of the fishermen, with the crinkled corners of their eyes. I think it's a little late for that. I look over Dove's back at him. Tell me how else I get to save the house, and I'll stay home. Would it be so bad to leave this house? I like it. It reminds me of Mum and Dad. And it's not even about the house. You know the first thing to go if we don't have it? Dove. I can't. I stop and busy myself, rubbing a smudge off the saddle. She's just a horse, Gabe says. Don't look at me like that. I know you love her, but you can live without her. You can get jobs here, and I'll send money back. And it'll be okay. I bury my fingers in Dove's mane. No, it won't be okay. I don't want to just get a job and work and be okay. I want Dove, and I want to have space to breathe. And I don't want Finn to work at the mill. I don't want to live in a closet in Skarmouth, with Finn in a separate little closet in Skarmouth, getting old. Then next year I'll have made enough that you can come to the mainland too. There are better jobs there. I don't want to come to the mainland. I don't want a better job. Don't you get it? I'm happy here. Not everyone wants to leave, Gabe. This is where I want to be. If I could have Dove and my space and a sack of beans, I'd call that enough. Gabriel looks at his feet and works his mouth, the way he used to when he and Dad would get into it, and he didn't like the corners he was being pushed into.
And that's worth dying for.
Yeah, I think it is. He works a loose splinter on the top of a board.
You didn't even think about it.
I don't have to. How about this? I won't race, and you'll stay here. But as I say it, I know that he'll say no, and that I'd race anyway.
Puck, Gabe says, I can't.
Well, I reply, pushing the gate open and leading Dove out past him. There you go. But I don't feel angry about it. There's the old sting, but no surprise. It feels like I've known all along, ever since I was little, that he was going to leave, and I'd just been ignoring it. I think Gabe knew too, when he started this conversation, that there was no way that he'd keep me and Dove off the beach. It was just something we both had to say. As I pass by, Gabe snags my arm. Dove amiably stops as he pulls me into a hug. He doesn't say anything. It is like any number of hugs he'd given me growing up, when the 6 years of difference between us was a canyon, me a child on one side, him an adult. I'll miss you, I say into his sweater. For once, it doesn't smell of fish. It smells of the hay that he moved for me the night before, and the smoke from the funeral pyre.
I'm sorry I made such a hash of things, he says. I should have trusted you both more. I wish that he'd said it before, before he was sad and scared. But I'll take it now. Gabe lets me go.
I'll go find where they're handing out the race colors.
He looks at me.
You look just like Mum right now.
Chapter 58. Sean. It is the first day of November, and so, today, someone will die. I hear a tap on my cracked door and it pushes open. How is Skarmuth's prize hero on the morning of the races? I open my eyes and turn my head to where George Holly stands in my doorway. He glances around at the furnishings of my small flat. There's nothing but a bed and a sink and a tiny stove shoved under the slanted ceiling. Everything turned lavender in the weak morning light. I give a nod that's both a greeting and a gesture for him to enter. "This is grim," he says. "You look grim as well." After a pause, he pulls a crate of tins out from next to the sink and sits on it, his legs folded up. He rests his red flat cap across his knees and strokes it like an animal. "I cannot settle," I say. I close my eyes. I can't go into his stall like this, or Cor will feel this on me, and I might as well not step foot on the beach at all.
"Is this about the races?" Holly asks. "Are you afraid of them?"
"I've never been afraid," I reply without opening my eyes. Holly says,
"Is this because you race for Cor this time? What is it you really want, Sean?"
I press my hand to my face, searching somewhere inside myself for the quiet that must be there, for the certainty I wear every year before every race, every morning before I get onto any horse.
"Is it the freedom? Don't bother with the race. Come back to the States with me and I'll make you partner in my stables. Not head groom, not head trainer. Come and go as you please."
When I still don't speak, Holly says, "Now, there you see. So you were lying to me when you told me it was the freedom you wanted. We've discovered it's not about the freedom at all. I call that progress." I turn my face away. Downstairs, I hear the commotion of the yard on race day and me not among it.
"So it's about the Red Stallion, then," you say. "You will lose the race and lose him in one swift stroke of Malvern justice. But you've won 4 years out of six, haven't you? And aren't those good odds? So I think it's not about that either."
I open my eyes. Holly shifts his weight under my gaze. The crate creaks beneath him. "Twice I've lost to Ian Privet on Pender. The third year he fell and lost Pender, and this year he has him again. Blackwell has Margot. She's a fast bitch," notes Holly, my words in his mouth. "And there is that Piebald. I don't know her. I think we should all be afraid of her. I think I could lose it all."
Holly scratches his neck and looks at the shadows beneath my narrow bed. "This, it all, seems to be the heart of it to me. When you say it all, do you by any chance mean Kate Connolly?"
"Ah, I see that you do."
I say, "Myself I can be sure of."
"Hmm," he says. "Don't say hmm to me, Mr. Holly. You can't come in here with your red hat and those shoes and play the wise man."
"Yes," says the man wearing no shoes at all, says Holly. He stands and takes the step that brings him to my stove. "How do you live here, Sean? How do you make a cup of tea without burning your Johnny? If you rolled over in your bed, you'd end up in the sink. Every morning is breakfast in bed because there's no floor to speak of."
"It's tolerable."
"Hmm," says Holly again. "Tolerable covers a wide range of situations. If you win, this is what you come back to?"
"My father's house is an hour's walk from here, on the northwestern cliffs. If I was free to live anywhere, that's where I'd live. I can't quite remember living in my father's home, though I've ridden by it before. My memories of the space inside are fragmented. Me in bed, me at a window, my mother in a chair. It's quite run down now. It's still in my name, but it's too far to serve me well working for Malvern." That's where you would keep the broodmare I just bought until she had a lovely red colt by your stallion? I reach for my socks on the radiator and the boots beneath them. I didn't say I would start a yard.
You didn't have to. I'll come back next year and you'll have a nest of horses outside your window and Puck Conley in your bed, and I'll buy from you instead of Malvern. That's your future for you.
Oh, the future sounds much kinder in your accent, I sigh, and reach for my jacket.
Where are you going? I'm not nearly done with my prognostication.
I shoulder on my jacket.
To the beach. You'll never get that colt of yours if I don't win Cor.
Chapter 59 Puck. In the night, I've shrunk and everyone else on the island has grown. They're all 9 feet tall, and men, and I'm 4 feet, and a child. Dove, too, is a toy, or possibly a dog, as I lead her through the throngs of people. The cliff road is already seething. The early races began hours ago, and fifths are running the short skirmishes down on the sand. I hear groans and laughs from the spectators on the cliff. The wind tears at us all. I peer up at the clouds, but they're lackluster clouds, the sort that stay for a moment, not a day. I'm relieved. I'd thought it might be as ill as the day that we'd found Tommy dead on the beach. It is cold, but it's November. I expected cold. Everyone's watching me and I keep hearing my name. Or keep thinking that I hear it anyway. Someone spits at Dove's hooves. Or maybe my feet. I hear exclamations in broad mainland accents. And comments about my breeding in Thisbe's clipped one. I feel strangely like I'm the stranger and the tourist, come to visit a friendless island. Everyone's touching Dove, and she's flighty and uncertain. At one point, she lifts her head and whinnies, though there's no one on this side of the island to answer her. Far down on the beach, a Kapil Ishka screams back. Dove shivers and drags me at the end of the lead. It takes my heels several feet to find traction again. I hear laughter, and someone asks if I need help. Not in a nice way. I snarl. What I need is for your mother to have thought a little harder 9 months before your birthday.
She bites, says someone.
I seal my mouth shut and push farther on. Somewhere in this mess is Gabe, possibly, with my colours. And Finn, possibly, with my lunch.
Kate Connolly, do you mean to change the establishment?
I blink and step backward. There's a man directly in front of me, dressed in a brown suit that looks like it costs more than our house. And he holds a notebook. Behind him stands a photographer with a massive flashbulb. There is an edge of people behind me and Dove. I feel cornered. I'm not trying to change anything but my own situation. I say.
So, you wouldn't say you were inspired by the women's suffrage movement?
I crane my neck around, looking for my brothers, or for Dory Maud, or for anyone that I know. I've never seen so many bowler hats in my life. I'm just a person with a horse. Same as anyone else on this island. Do you mind? You're making my horse nervous. The reporter asks.
What would you say to those on Thisbe who say you don't belong in the Scorpio races?
I don't have a clever answer for you, I say crossly.
Just one more, Miss Connolly. Where do you think you'll end up? Do you think you'll stand a chance of finishing?
They trot to keep up with me as I turn Dove's shoulder toward them. I'm oddly undone by the reporter and the photographer more than anything I've encountered so far. I haven't considered eyes on me, much less eyes all the way from a mainland newspaper. I scowl at him.
Go ask at Grattan's. They know everything.
I try to turn Dove again, to push them away from me.
Puck!
I turn in the direction of my name. My insides roar, and there is Sean. Unlike me, who had to push through this crowd. He cuts neatly through the people. They make room for him, as if unaware that they do. He is in only white shirt sleeves, and he's out of breath.
which is to say that for a moment I cannot believe it's him. He comes in close, turning his back to the reporter, and ducks his head to me.